Hey guys, Bill here, and today's show is brought to you by our pals at SeatGeek. And whether you're going to the NFC or AFC championship games, if you're a Chiefs fan who wants to go and take advantage of your shot at possibly seeing the first Super Bowl trip for the Chiefs since 1969, here is your opportunity not only to go see the Chiefs, but see whatever you want to see, whether it's a sporting event, whether it's a concert, anything that involves tickets, you can go purchase those tickets with our pals at SeatGeek. And in case you haven't used SeatGeek before, just FYI, you're going to get a good deal because SeatGeek's going all around the web. They're using their deal score technology to rate the tickets so you know you're getting a good deal. And even better, you're going to get $10 off when you make your first SeatGeek purchase. Do that. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter in promo code Barnwell at checkout today. That's my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Enter in promo code Barnwell and get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. SeatGeek. Life's an event. We have the tickets. Now on to the show. Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here on Monday, January 14th, 2019. The divisional round is up. For those of you who are expecting upsets, well, we got four games going pretty much like chalk. And so we previewed the AFC last week. Today we are going to recap the NFC. I'm going to cover those two games on today's show. Joining me first to do that, excellent writer many places around the web, but most recently, USA Today Sports Media Group, the wonderful former colleague of mine, Doug Ferrara, is here. Doug, how are you?
Good, Bill. How are you today?
Good. I am a little surprised we didn't get any upsets, and I am also surprised that the game that ended up coming closest to one is the game we're going to start about here, which is the Eagles-Saints game. A game where the Eagles started, I think it's surprising to say, at least to me, got up 14-0 in the first quarter and then basically did not do anything else on offense for the remainder of the game. The Saints rolled off 20 consecutive points to win the game. Of course, they had a little bit of a late scare with the missed field goal by Will Lutz and the ensuing Eagles drive, which ended with the Marshawn Lattimore interception off the Alshon Jeffrey drop. But Doug, let's start here. In terms of this game, in terms of what changed over the course of the game, why were the Eagles succeeding early in this contest on offense? And what were the factors that caused them to basically just shut down and shrivel up on offense for the remainder of the game?
Couple things happened, and over the last two seasons, it's been the sort of morphing of Dennis Allen's defensive mm-hmm. philosophy has been really weird, because he tends to start off a season playing a lot of zone, mm-hmm. a lot of complementary coverages, and then he realizes, oh, I don't really have the players for that, and then he goes to man/match/press coverage, mm-hmm. and he tends to follow people more as opposed to, you know, kind of a homogenous, you know, go with the guy you're closest to kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The touchdown, I mean, that was just a blown coverage, but in general, what happened in the second half, and Foles had a lot of deep incompletions in the second half, was mm-hmm. a couple things. Marshawn Lattimore started shadowing Alshon Jeffrey, mm-hmm. and the Saints played a ton more press coverage. They also started running some games and stunts to pressure Foles, because the Saints realized, okay, this is a three-step drop, quick out offense, and we have to at least get Foles off his spot on those types of throws. And certainly if he's running 5 to 7 step drops, as he obviously has to for more deep stuff, mm-hmm. they have to get to him. And Foles has never been a good passer under pressure. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons it worked out so well for him last year was that they kept him relatively clean. Mm-hmm. Well, the Saints not only got pressure on Foles, especially on the deep stuff. I don't have the numbers, but I would imagine he was at least like 0 for 4 or 1 for 5 on stuff 20 yards in the air or more in the second half. It just mm-hmm. didn't work. And part of that was press coverage to disrupt his reads. Part of it was just pressure in his face, which mm-hmm. he doesn't do well with. And, you know, that changed there. I would say on the other side of the ball, and I wrote about this last week to the certainly the consternation of Saints fans who were all over me on Twitter for a couple of days, that Drew Brees did not have a good December. He was greatly affected by pressure, mm-hmm. and especially pressure in his face, which he was getting a lot of, which with the Saints offensive line having their own issues. He tended to shorten his follow-through on throws, mm-hmm. and the LeBlanc interception was exactly another example of that. For whatever reason, Philadelphia was not getting pressure in the second half. Breeze was able to move around the pocket, find the throwing lanes like he does so well, mm-hmm. and complete those passes. Michael Thomas also made some great contested catch receptions, mm-hmm. which he is certainly going to have to do in the NFC Championship game because he's about to be Aqib Talib's best buddy. but those were the things that changed for me in the second half.
All right, so let's unpack those, a few different things to talk about there. We can begin with the Saints defense. Were you surprised they didn't start this game with Marshawn Lattimore shadowing Alshon Jeffrey?
As I said, given the tendencies where I think, and it's funny, I was reflecting on this morning mm-hmm. on Twitter, how like the Chargers played that, you know, spot drop cover three thing mm-hmm. against Brady to everyone's hilarity. And then they tried to play man coverage and it was even worse because they're not a man coverage. They're not man coverage personnel. Mm-hmm. I think Dennis Allen wants his team to play good zone, and they just are not built that way. Especially when they got Eli Apple, they started to play a lot more man, and mm-hmm. it played overall a lot better. They're a very good, aggressive, and you can say man, you can say match coverage, which starts off as zone and goes into man.
Right.
You can play like two-man where you're pressing and then rolling in man, but this isn't the Seahawks. You know, mm-hmm. it's... If anything, it's more the Patriots. Patriots, heavy, heavy, heavy man team. Mm-hmm. So I think Dennis Allen wants, you know, I haven't talked to Dennis Allen about this. I'm not in his head. But given the tendency Allen has to rely on zone until mm-hmm. it's like, you know, break glass and start man coverage in case of emergency, it kind of seems to be when he does it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this would qualify. I mean, Jeffrey was having a very solid game. Like you said, to your point, Nick Foles started with two long completions on deep throws, the touchdown pass to Matthews on the blown coverage, a 30-yard completion to Alshon Jeffrey over Lattimore, and then things kind of turned on that Nick Foles interception where he had a bunch of time to throw and tried to hit Zach Ertz over Lattimore. Lattimore picked it off, and then from there, 0-for-3 on passes, 20 or more yards downfield, none in the third quarter, all in the fourth quarter. And I know part of this is just that the Eagles' offensive line got significantly worse during the game. Brandon Brooks tore his Achilles, sadly. Jason Peters was out for a good chunk of this game, I think 17 offensive snaps, which was about 25% or 30% of the game, replaced by Hal Vaitai, who, you know, Hal Vaitai is a solid swing tackle, but it's not Jason Peters. It's not a Hall of Fame caliber left tackle. So I guess the part that I wonder about, and this is maybe just being too much of a Monday morning quarterback, and I'm someone who's very pass-friendly. I always want teams to throw the ball more. The Eagles ran the ball three times in the second half, and it's not as if they were throwing the ball all over the field. Nick Foles was 6 of 14 for 45 yards in the second half. I mean, is there, you know, you don't want to say run pass just for the sake of saying run pass, but are you surprised they didn't try to do more things to try and change things up, given how the Saints are playing them on defense?
You tend to wonder how that third quarter drive, which lasted longer than Gary Cherone's tenure in the NFL, you tend to wonder how and if that affected Philadelphia's offensive philosophy, mm-hmm. where things tend to compound upon each other and the snowball rolls downhill, and we're not getting on the field, and we're not getting on the field, we're not getting on the field, and oh my flipping God, what are we going to do? And you start to get impatient, and you start to think you need shot plays even when you don't.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Not knowing what Peterson was thinking, that would be my hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And I mean, obviously, you know, the running game wasn't working either in the first half or the second half. It really was just a carry or two where Wendell Smallwood got to the second level. So, I mean, no guarantee that would have fixed things by any means, but obviously one of the more pass-happy second half you'll see from a team given the, you know, relatively close score.
Especially after Sheldon Rankins was out, because and this does not bode well for them, certainly against C.J. Anderson and the Rams. He's been their interior rock, and he's out mm-hmm. for at least the first part of next season without Achilles, which is brutal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, both teams suffered a serious Achilles injury in this game with Brandon Brooks and Sheldon Rankin. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's too hard to say. You want to look back at the old 22 and see if, you know, there were spots to run the football. But I think certainly it just stood out to me watching, you know, looking at the numbers and watching that game during the second half. Peterson, I don't know how to talk about this. And I'm not sure I agree with or disagree with it. I want to know what you think in terms of the decision to not accept that 3rd-and-1 penalty. Of course, just as a reminder, these Saints had a 3rd-and-1 deep in their own territory. They committed a penalty on they were stuffed on 3rd-and-1 on a Mark Ingram run. So they would have theoretically punted from their own 30-yard line. Ryan Ramczyk held on the play. Doug Peterson declines the penalty. And then the Saints run a fake punt for 4 yards and pick up the first down, end up scoring a touchdown on that drive on 4th down later on the drive on that, really cool, you know, fake screen and corner route from Keith Kirkwood. Do you fault Peterson for not accepting the penalty? Is that just, you know, again, Monday morning quarterbacking, or do you think in the moment he should have accepted the penalty and forced the Saints or prevented the Saints from considering a fake punt on 4th down either way?
Sean Payton did an onside kick in the second half in the Super Bowl.
Yes.
So, and you know, it's funny to say this as someone who wrote for Football Outsiders for a long time. You could talk to 500 people who are more in tune with like the percentage of or the, you know, if we do this 100 times, 55% of the time it works, and sure, you know, 45% it doesn't. I'd say given the extent to which Sean Payton is prone to put his balls on the table at any given moment, I don't know how much of a difference it made.
Yeah, I mean, I think Payton is one of the, like, I think typically, I wouldn't even think about it. It's an immediate, obvious, you know, we're going to decline the penalty and this team's going to punt because they're not going to try to, you know, win the game down 14-0 in the first quarter on their own 30-yard line, or early in the second quarter on their own 30-yard line. But like you said, Payton is one of the most aggressive coaches in football, selectively, when he wants to be. They're very aggressive about fakes and very aggressive about trying different things. And I think furthermore, they were down 14-0. Everything was going right for them in this game. It felt like they were out of it. So in the moment, I don't fault Peterson for doing it. I think he would be getting more flack today had he accepted the penalty and they converted for on 3rd-and-long for a 1st down than he would be given what actually happened. But it doesn't shock me in the way that it would shock me with other coaches in the division around in that same situation.
I think, you know, if you talk about the little deaths in any game, the paper cuts that where you start to bleed and it really gets bad. I would, you know, I look at the Eagles' inability to get pressure on Breeze in the second half as probably the number one demolition. I look at the Saints realizing, hey, we're not a good zone defense, so let's stop doing it, especially off coverage. Because you can play off cover man and tight zone, you know what I mean. But they change their philosophy. I mean, when I see a game like that where there are two fairly big swings in overall philosophy and personnel and execution, I tend to look less at one play.
Yeah.
Like, you know, one play games, I look at it like it comes down, you know, where it comes down to one obvious play, run the ball in Super Bowl 49, for God's sake, something like that. I tend to throw more weight at it, but, you know, as I said, you could talk to 500 people who would have more of an opinion on that. You know, the particular swings on strategic decisions like that.
And I mean, realistically, there was still a lot for the Saints to do on that drive. You know, they still had to go 66 yards to score a touchdown in that game, let alone, you know, what happened next, what happened in the rest of the game. And I think that it's, you know, it's too simplistic to say, oh, the Eagles would have won the game if they had just stopped them there, because they wouldn't have. There's still so much more of that game to go. And you mentioned Breece's interception where he seemed to not throw the ball in the way that you might expect given his stature, given his success rate, even during most of the regular season. Were you surprised to see it still be an issue after really what amounted to 2 weeks of rest?
No. This has been a problem since the Cowboys game. And the Cowboys did a couple things. Mm-hmm. They ran inside games to get pressure in his face. Mm-hmm. And they played bullseye coverage. They didn't jump the route so much as they jumped the timing of the catch. And the moment at which the receiver caught the ball, a defender was there to disrupt it, mm-hmm. to make him pay for it. They were also very good at getting in front of Breeze's receivers and sort of winning contested catch possibilities. But the real problem that Breeze has had for me since about week 13, and he's not like an extended follow-through guy. Mm-hmm. Number one, because he's not tall. So he's not Mike Glennon. He doesn't need 5 minutes to complete a throw. He doesn't have an elongated delivery. He's very abbreviated in his steps. He's very efficient. Mm-hmm. But what I've been noticing is that, especially when he has pressure in his face and he has to move around, he's not following through as he does. He's not using his lower body to create torque. He'll sort of half throw it. Mm-hmm. And that leads to a lot of instances in which the ball doesn't go exactly where he wants it to. Mm-hmm. The velocity is affected. The arc is affected. So that LeBlanc interception, I mean, if you watch it and then go watch, because he had, what, 3 touchdowns and 3 interceptions in the last month of the season. Mm-hmm. After maybe being even better than Patrick Mahomes in the first 12 games. So this is not... this is not anything new. And I did a tape piece on it last week, watched most of his incompletions, mm-hmm. and saw a lot of the same thing, and he's not following through. It's like a golfer, you're not really sure where the ball's going to go. Mm-hmm. Now, things changed. You know, and the problem he has now is the Rams, they have this guy Aaron Donald, who's fairly decent at creating interior pressure.
He's fairly decent at creating interior pressure, and he's going up against the interior of the Saints offensive line, which seems like it might be compromised to some extent with Andres Pete having a broken hand. I mean, he committed a bunch of penalties in this game, did not seem like his usual self. Teron Armstead allowed a strip sack from Michael Bennett, I believe. And the Eagles have a great defensive line. I don't think it's anything, to be ashamed of, to think that they played you really well and gave your quarterback pressure for a good chunk of this game, but... Yeah, are you
focused more on? I think they focused more on coverage than pressure in the second half. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the overhead yet, but that's what it seemed like.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about the Saints holding up more so than you would be typically against Aaron Donald?
I'm concerned about Breeze holding up against any team that presents interior pressure if he can't get out of it. Mm-hmm. The Cowboys, and it didn't show up against the Rams, unfortunately for them. Cowboys have a great ability to get pressure inside. They don't blitz, they run a ton of end tackle stunts.
Right.
So they're able to, with their personnel and with their defensive philosophy, basically bowl a quarterback out of stepping up in the pocket and then prevent him from getting outside the pocket and creating extended throwing lanes. And doing things sort of after the play breaks down and the route breaks off. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll see what happens. You know, Fowler's been pretty good. The Rams don't have those outside guys, but they may not need them. I mean, you pointed out the Saints' offensive line troubles. You know, and Michael Thomas lit the Rams up, but I don't think Talib was in that game. I think it was Marcus Peters, and mm-hmm. Marcus Peters doesn't have to cover number one receivers anymore. Which I'm sure Marcus Peters is very happy about. So this could be a very different experience for a number of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron Donald did not sack Drew Brees the first time these two teams played, but knocked him down 4 times. Drew Brees had a 61.8 passer rating under pressure when these teams played earlier this season. So, I mean, certainly when they were able to get pressure on Brees, they gave him trouble, and he had 346 yards and 4 touchdowns in the game, but you would figure if Aqib Talib is doing work on Michael Thomas, who was incredible in this game, by the way. I don't mean to sell him short. Who was awesome in this game. And if you have Aaron Donald against a compromised Andres Pete in pass protection or twisting to face Armstead, who's on 100% in pass protection, well, suddenly, you know, this might be a different game in terms of what the Rams defense can do.
Talib is not a good that is not a good matchup for Thomas, because Aqib is, he's so aggressive, mm-hmm. and he's so smart with it. Peters is aggressive to his own detriment. It's like he's still on the Chiefs in that regard. Mm-hmm. But Tlaib, you know, he'll bait you and he'll attack you, and then he'll know when to back off. He'll know when to jump the route. He's just very, very heady that way. I mean, Thomas can certainly bring it all the way physically. Mm-hmm. But I think Tlaib could put him in some contested catch situations that he's not optimal for, and mm-hmm. I think contested catches are going to be a big deal for Breeze if they get to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it certainly could be. I mean, this is a game where they converted in that second half, 2nd and 20, 3rd and 16 on that endless drive, 3rd and 13 on the next drive. I mean, it was really incredible to see what Breeze and most of those catches Michael Thomas was doing. Last question for you, Doug. And this is just me being simple, me being basic. How did Michael Thomas fall to the second round in a draft where Corey Coleman, Will Fuller, Josh Doctson, Laquon Treadwell, and Sterling Shepard were all taken before him?
How did C.J. Anderson get released by 3 different teams, including the Raiders, before the Rams got him? Where would Michael Thomas have been elsewhere? Where would Russell Wilson have been in Jacksonville? You know, without knowing what teams think, I tend mm-hmm. to think that the guys who drastically outplay their draft selection, mm-hmm. they landed in the right place.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he landed in the right place. I think that's, you know, certainly the case. But it did seem great that the Saints, you know, had Marquise Colston for years, seemed to be set at receiver, you know, trade Jimmy Graham, and then suddenly they have the perfect receiver for their offense in a lot of ways just fall into their laps in the second round. Must be nice.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at what I wrote about him, because I remember watching his college tape and doing a report. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that specifically, but, you know, I'll say in general, really good circumstance for him. His attributes obviously fit with what the Saints need out of their number one receiver. Because it's interesting with them, they have never in the Peyton era wanted their number one receiver to be the speed guy.
Right.
That's usually the 2 and 3, the second and 3 reads on a trips or bunch side.
Right.
They want that guy to be heady with the routes, certainly the curls, certainly the slant, certainly the comeback, the dig, anything from 8 to 17 yards. He needs to be a Rhodes Scholar, mm-hmm. and then we'll throw it 40 yards downfield to Ted Ginn. So. You know, he fits what they do, and that's all they needed.
Yeah. Well, Doug, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Where can people check out more of the stuff you're doing?
Touchdown Wire on the USA Today Sports Media Group site. A whole bunch of stuff there and a whole bunch of stuff coming.
And you're on social media as well.
Yes. NFL_Doug Fuller.
Doug, thank you so much. And they're going to have you back on during the Super Bowl. We'll have some X's and O's stuff to discuss, and if the Saints do make it, or if the Rams make it, I guess we'll have a lot to talk about. But Doug, thanks so much for coming on. We're going to come back with Ted Wynn and talk about the Rams and Cowboys after the break here on the Bill Barnwell Show. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Still me, still where I work. Joining me now, though, a different guest. We had Doug Farrar from USA Today earlier on the show. Right now, we are joined by someone who is frequently requested from the listeners on this show, one of my favorite guests. It is The Athletic's Ted Wynn. Ted, how are you?
Doing well. I didn't know I was frequently requested, so thank you, people that put in those requests.
You are highly regarded. You always, you know, you give us information that I don't have. I'm not someone who is anywhere near as versed in the X's and O's of the sport as you, so I'm learning a lot about how teams win games, and I'm very intrigued to hear what you think about the Rams-Cowboys game. You were an attendee. You were attending as a member of the media on Saturday night for this Rams-Cowboys game. And I want to figure out what you saw, you know, watching the game afterwards, but also just what you saw from the sidelines. How, in terms of this game plan, in terms of what happened with the Rams in this game, the story afterwards has been, oh, well, the Rams got back to what they do best. They were physical. They were running teams, you know, running the Cowboys off the line of scrimmage, and they were very good running the football in this game. What about their running game worked on Saturday night against the Cowboys?
Well, a couple things. When they struggled to run the ball against the Eagles and Bears mm-hmm. in towards the end of the season, my coworker Vincent, he just wrote a story on The Athletic about how the coaching staff and the front office really made it a point that they want to fix this running game because they know that everything they do on offense is based on this running game and having success on the ground. So even against the Cardinals and the Niners towards the end of the season, they could have they felt like they could have passed to win the game, but they decided that they're going to really focus in and fix this running game. And yeah, they did go back to running the ball, but they also broke a bunch of tendencies that they might have showed on film earlier in the season against the Cowboys, and I think that really befuddled them. For example, the Rams almost never run the ball from shotgun, and on the first drive of the game, they ran an inside zone from shotgun, and it popped off for 12 yards, and before the snap, the linebackers were already dropping back because they were expecting pass, because I think the stat was like they passed the ball from shotgun like 90% of the time. So it was just breaking a bunch of tendencies like that, and just the blocking up front was just great from them. And I talked a little bit more about some technical changes they made in the blocking scheme in my article that I'm actually writing for The Athletic right now.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you're going to make changes, this is the time to make them. And showing stuff against a good Cowboys run defense that's well coached and is going to recognize sort of what you've done on film over the past few weeks, it makes sense. This is the time you change it. But I mean, they were also running the ball effectively in week 16 and week 17 with CJ Anderson. Are you shocked? This is a guy who was on the street for most of the year, and he looked awesome against the Cowboys on Saturday night.
Yeah, I mean, Anderson has always been one of the most intelligent backs, and Peyton Manning gave him a lot of credit for how smart of a player he is. And yeah, it is surprising because, yeah, he came off the street, and he played in a similar system with the Broncos.
Right.
But just to learn the entire Rams system and just execute at such a high level as far as setting up his blocks, knowing the scheme, making his cuts, that was really surprising to me. And just looking at him, he looks kind of out of shape, too. So it's kind of funny to see him just play so well just off the street. And one thing Kirk Morrison told me, Kirk Morrison played linebacker for the Raiders, and he covered the Rams. I just talked to him about some Rams stuff, and he said something pretty interesting. He said Todd Gurley is more of a guy that takes a while to cut. He builds up his speed, and he could take a little while to cut. But Anderson's a guy where if he sees a cut or a crease, he could hit it right away. And that made a big difference in a Rams offense.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, seeing him, some of his jump cuts in the backfield where he just made a cut and he was gone. He was gone straight up the hole. And you figure, okay, well, here's this guy who looks like Jerome Bettis-y or Mike Tolbert-y in the offense. Like, not what I was expecting from CJ Anderson when I thought about him in Carolina, thought about him in Denver. But, I mean, he still has plenty of burst and plenty of athleticism. And for a guy who spent most of the year on the bench in Carolina and then sitting out and, you know, bounced around a couple teams for a week or two, you know, he has a lot of life in his legs. He looks like someone who still has, you know, a lot to give here in January when not every back is going to be 100%. And that includes, perhaps, I'm going to ask you what you think, Todd Gurley, where Todd Gurley missed the final 2 weeks of the year with an injury. He was banged up in the Chiefs game. He has, you know, ankle and knee injury, certainly, over the past few weeks. Did he look 100% to you when he was on the field this weekend?
I thought so. I mean, I think he looked like he even had more pop just because he wasn't on the field all the time. And I'm not sure what the percentage was, but it seemed like Gurley, when he was healthy without Anderson there, was playing a lot of snaps and having a spell back and just switching carries. He looked like he was really fresh on the carries that he did get.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think he looked fine. I think he looked totally fine. I don't feel like I'm qualified to say it based on one game. And I think you'd probably have a better instinct just from being there and seeing how he was performing, you know, in the stadium itself versus me watching it, you know, on tape or on TV. But I thought he looked fine. And I think that this is going to be a really interesting offense to watch next week. And if they make it to the Super Bowl, because they were so frequently, in not only in the same personnel, but with the same exact players on the field for most of this regular season. And now, I mean, CJ Anderson is needs to get a reasonable amount of this workload. He had 23 carries for 123 in the victory against the Cowboys. They're not necessarily going to run the ball as much in the games to come. It's hard to say. We won't know for a while. But, I mean, it does seem like he's going to get a good chunk of the workload and deserves it. So I wonder if that changes how McVay is going to call plays and how, you know, he's going to sort of show his tendencies, given that Anderson has only really been on the team for 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's just such a great pickup that late in the season that could just have a huge impact. I mean, obviously, it already had a huge impact. They won a playoff game, and he was a huge part of it, too. So it's just, I guess it's rare to see a late pickup like this pay that much dividends.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he got 23 carries. How many touches did he get? Or how many snaps did he play in this game? He played 34 snaps in this game. So it wasn't even like, you know, the Cowboys could sit there and say, okay, when C.J. Anderson comes on the field, we know they're running the football. Like, he was able to do enough as a receiver. He only had, I believe, he ran four routes. He had one pass block in this game. So it wasn't like he, you know, it wasn't like it was an obvious, immediate, guaranteed tell that when they brought him in the game, he was going to run the football. So, I mean, they can play off this. And I think that with the Saints and their defense coming up, they just lost Sheldon Rankins to a, you know, to a torn Achilles in the loss, or in that loss, in the victory to the Eagles yesterday. So you would figure, and I want to know what you think about their game plan coming into this coming week. Do you think they're going to try and stick with this run heavy approach? Do you really think they believe what they said on Saturday?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I mean, they ran the ball against, I really did not think that they could run the ball this well against that Cowboys defense with that speed on the field. And they ran for over 200 yards. So if they could run for over 200 yards against the Cowboys, I think they have a pretty good chance of running the ball with great success against the Saints as well. Maybe they throw in some more tendency breakers and come out and use more play action and pass the ball to set up the run. But I think eventually they're going to really try to establish a run game at some point in that Saints game.
So on the defensive side of the ball, the Rams did a pretty good job of bottling up Ezekiel Elliott in this game as a runner. But Dak Prescott had a good amount of success as a passer, 20 of 32 for 266. Did have a pick six dropped by Ebikam during the game. There was a lot of opportunities to make plays. The Cowboys isolated Amari Cooper against LaMarcus Joyner in the slot on that first touchdown pass. They got a long pass to Michael Gallup when Joyner got flat-footed on a scramble drill. Are you concerned about their ability to stop the big play against Drew Brees?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, against the Cowboys, they were just really focused on stopping Elliott. They stayed in the bare front for a lot of the game. They were just really challenging Prescott to beat them deep. And he had some nice plays, but he just couldn't do it on a consistent basis. And those couple three and outs in the middle of the second quarter really hurt them. So, I think the Saints are a lot more complete offensively than the Cowboys are. So they have a chance to punish the Rams defense for trying to stack up against the run too much. I think Teddy Ginn Jr. coming back is huge for the Saints as well. They were searching so hard for a number two receiver, signing Dez Bryant, and he got injured, and just Teddy Ginn Jr. coming back. And you can see in the first play of the game against the Saints, he had an opportunity for a big play if Drew Brees didn't underthrow that ball to him. So I think Ginn is a big X factor with his speed to maybe beat the Cowboys deep. I think that I'd be worried about the Rams defense giving up too many big plays against the Saints for sure.
Yeah, and the first time these two teams played, we talked about this a little bit with Doug earlier in the show. Drew Brees was 25-36 for 346 and four touchdowns. Michael Thomas was 12-15 for 211 and a touchdown. An enormous game. That was the cell phone game, if you remember his celebration. I mean, obviously, you know, they didn't have Ted Ginn in that game, the Saints, and the Rams did not have Aqib Talib in that first game. So you would figure that's going to change what we see from the Saints offense in general when it comes to that specific contest. But for the Rams, I mean, do you think they go into Sunday and they have Aqib Talib against Michael Thomas and just sort of hope that Marcus Peters can hold up against Ted Ginn on the other side of the field?
Yeah, well, the Rams don't travel, don't have their corners travel much, and they didn't do it against the Cowboys. They, Talib stays on one side and Peters stays on one side. I think they're happy with that, but the thing is with Michael Thomas, having to match up with Michael Thomas, who plays in the slot a lot, he moves outside sometimes too, they might have to change their strategy because Thomas against Joyner or whoever they have in the slot is not a good matchup for them.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. We saw Amari Cooper exploit that on the first touchdown pass in this game, and Amari Cooper had a solid game. It was not Michael Gallup's game. Michael Gallup was the star of the game for the Cowboys in terms of receiving production, but Cooper was productive, and I mean, obviously, it's not end the way he was hoping, but 6 of 65 for a touchdown. Do you do you think the criticism, not criticism, maybe that's the wrong word, but after the game, it seems like there was at least conversation on Raiders Twitter, which you're a part of still as a not only national writer, but also someone who's local to the Raiders, that Amari Cooper cared more about this game and was trying harder in this game in the playoffs than he had been during his time with the Oakland Raiders. Do you think that's fair, or do you think that's borne out by what you saw during this game and what you saw from him with the Raiders?
I mean, so people are saying because he's showing a little more emotion and he kind of pushed back on Tlaib after Peters kind of choked him out a little bit, that he's showing more passion with the Cowboys. And I do think that you get, you know, players get revitalized when they're kind of given up on and traded to another team. So I think there is going to be a natural spike in emotion and for Cooper. But I think the narrative that Cooper gave up in Oakland is just not true. He got open a lot, and you know the Raiders just couldn't find him for various reasons, whether it's protection or whether Carr looked the other way. So I think if you just get the ball more and you get targeted more, you're going to be a little more emotionally riled up. So I don't think that Cooper gave up in Oakland. I think that he had a new start in Dallas, and he's in the playoffs, and he's getting targeted more, so he's showing a little more emotion, but I don't think that he gave up in Oakland.
Do you think how he's played during his time in Dallas, does it make you feel good? Because you sit there and say to yourself, oh, well, he was actually a good player all along, and you know, as a fan and as an analyst, when you saw him get open, it wasn't just, you know, like it was proof that he was playing well and just wasn't getting the ball enough in Oakland, so it kind of confirms how you felt about that. Or was it frustrating because, as a Raiders fan, you had a very talented wide receiver, and now you don't have a talented wide receiver?
Yeah, and I feel both of those things. I feel like I'm validated because I was like, yeah, Cooper's been this good player that I thought he was all along. But this, at the same time, yeah, it stinks losing a receiver and getting a first-round draft pick and then having the hope that you could draft maybe a wide receiver that could have that same sort of impact. So it's frustrating at the same time.
It's not great. And I mean, you know, I think you were someone who was writing about this before the trade, when they were discussing Cooper during the offseason. I mean, I think he's a legitimate top 15. Is that number fair to say wide receiver? I don't know where you'd put him in terms of your wide receiver rankings, but I mean, certainly the Cowboys got everything they could have hoped for when they made this trade.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say he's elite of the elite, but he's bordering on that that kind of status. And you know, when you draft a receiver, you hope to find one that could get to that level. So, yeah, I mean, I'm happy for him, but I think it's a loss in Oakland. We'll see how that trade ends up happening, but it's tough to find a receiver that plays at that level.
Yeah, I mean, all those Raiders draft picks, so the first rounders they were hoping to get that were going to be hopefully in the middle of the round or even higher. I mean, the Bears, of course, made the playoffs and were very good. The Cowboys are in the playoffs. Those picks are going to fall a lot deeper than John Gruden was expecting when he made those two trades. Obviously, still really early in terms of the week, so we'll finish up with this. But in terms of your thoughts about the Rams-Saints matchup, what do you think is the best or most plausible way for Sean McVay to approach this game? Like, what's sort of the formula for a Rams victory against the Saints in New Orleans in the NFC Championship game, if there's one that makes sense to you?
I think that they have to take their deep shots, and they didn't really do that against the Cowboys because they didn't have to. The Cowboys were playing a lot of zone, and they're running the ball so well that Goff didn't really have to go outside of himself and throw the ball deep much, if at all. So I think against the Saints that they're really going to have to try to be aggressive because the Saints defense has been good, but they've given up some big plays as well. And, they play a lot of man coverage, bump and run man coverage. Mm-hmm. So if you beat them deep early and get them to back off, I think they're a lot less effective. So I think with the McVay, going into this game, I think they have to game plan some deep shots.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense. The Saints are one of the worst teams in the league on deep passes, and the Eagles, I mean, Nick Foles, not really his game, but they had a couple shots early on that were successful before the Saints, you know, changed their defense. And as Doug mentioned in the first half of the show, went with more man coverage, put Marshawn Lattimore on Alshon Jeffrey, and then kind of slowed things down. Were you pleased with what you saw from Jared Goff in this game? I mean, obviously they had that late keeper to seal things up, but overall, do you think this was an impressive performance from him against the Cowboys?
I can't say it's too impressive. I thought he missed. There were a few passes he just straight up missed. Mm-hmm. But he executes the offense well, and he did hit some nice crossing patterns. But he left some opportunities on the field as well. So if I were to give him a letter grade, I'd probably say a B, better mm-hmm. than average. But he wasn't lights out or anything against against the Cowboys. I think he's going to have to play a lot better against the Saints.
Do you think they can win with a B against the Saints? Or do you think he has to have an A performance for them to win?
That depends on a running game, because I didn't expect that sort of running game against the Cowboys. And if they dominate on the ground against the Saints, then a B performance from Goff would probably be fine.
Yeah, I think if they get 273 yards on the ground against the Saints and lose, it's going to be a really fascinating game. I don't know what's going to happen to make that happen, but I will be happy to watch that if that's how it goes down. All right, Ted. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show today, and you do wonderful work for The Athletic, and please plug that in your social media.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at FB_film analysis. You can find my work on The Athletic. We're doing a ton of playoff coverage right now, going to the Senior Bowl and doing draft coverage there as well. So make sure you subscribe if you haven't yet.
Awesome. Ted, it's always a pleasure. Have you back on later on in the year, but thanks so much for hopping on today.
All right, awesome. Thanks for having me on.
All right, thanks so much to our guest today, Doug Farrar of USA Today Sports Media Group, Ted Wynn of The Athletic, two great X's and O's people. If you want to follow them, highly recommend you doing so. You'll learn a lot more about the game, and you can yell at me on Twitter about how dumb I am, because they are much smarter people than I am when it comes to covering the National Football League. But we'll have more audio coming for you later this week. A couple of guests lined up for a conference championship preview show live from the studio in Bristol. So thanks so much for listening, and more coming later this week.